Brown, the inventor of the Steadicam, a camera brace which a camera operator wears, on which a movie camera literally floats, so that the operator can run up and down stairs, jump over things, move around corners, and in general move in a way which is limited only by his or her acrobatic ability. Garrett is based in Philadelphia, but travels all over the country. In 1978, Garrett won an Oscar for the Steadicam. It was the first Oscar given in 10 years for a technical achievement. As well as training other people on how to use the Steadicam, Garrett is in constant demand as a cameraman. And here's a partial list of the films on which he's worked. Here's The Shining, Altered States, Willie and Phil, Fame, Fort Apache, The Bronx, The Formula, Stripes, and Endless Love. Taps with George C. Scott and One from the Heart, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and True Confessions with Robert De Niro are still in production. Since Garrett was last on Fresh Air, a few new films he's worked on have opened in Philadelphia, including Brian De Palma's Blowout and Michael Wadley's Wolfen, which makes extensive use of the unique abilities of the Steadicam. Well, welcome back to Fresh Air, Garrett.
Hi, Dan. Thanks.
Nice to have you on again, and I guess this is the third time. Let's start by talking about Blowout. That was, for one, filmed in Philadelphia and now still very much being watched in Philadelphia. You did the opening shot of the film. Could you describe what that shot was?
Well, that was a lot of fun. I was called to do the point of view of a lurching, derelict pervert, which is a role close to my heart. So I think it was sort of a tribute, conscious or unconscious, to the John Carpenter school of lurching, derelict, pervert kind of guy, right? And this was done to the fairly well at a college in the suburbs. They sprayed the trees so that ice would dangle from all the limbs, and they put lacy undergarments on the line through which the pervert had to make his way, and they populated the school with scantily clad girls, doing what one imagines scantily clad girls do in the winter in some school in the suburbs. And so I was to lurch up to the windows, look and drool and huff and puff and go from window to window. And needless to say, this was very tiresome work, looking through the window at these folks. And then I was to stab a guard, so they dressed my right hand in the wardrobe of the pervert, right? So the guard comes looking around, and I duck behind a bush. Are you sure you want to hear this? It's wonderful. Yet, stop me. You'll have to put tape over my mouth. Stop this. I come up behind the guard. My hand enters the shot, stabs the guy. He falls out of frame. This is, of course, folks, lugging this camera around, which is what I have to keep remembering, that the camera is my eyes. The camera is our, the viewer's point of view. So, and since the camera moves without a lot of bumps and grinds, this is more or less the way it should look, right, as a person's point of view. So then we follow another couple inside, and if you saw the film, you saw the final results of this with a couple of sections missing. I think they finally decided that the whole thing just went on too long. We did, in fact, get a bit carried away with girls coming and going and hiding and people abusing themselves in the corner in great arguments and people going into the shower and so on. But the final culmination of this was wonderful because they dressed two other souls with the appropriate sleeve and glove and weapons. One was the cameraman, Vilmos Zsigmond. He had his right hand dressed, and the other was the camera assistant, who was the only fellow that could fit into this one space with his left hand dressed to open the shower curtain. And as my hand opened the shower door and we went in, the actual fellow playing the perverted, derelict, lurching fellow was seen in the mirror. He, of course, was right to my right.
Did he walk through the whole shot with you?
No, he was waiting, as a matter of fact, in one of the shower stalls, not very patiently waiting for me to show up each take. And I was watching his face in the mirror, and then he started to turn, I started to turn, and our loyal ADs yanked him out of the way so that it appeared that your loyal pervert was turning and looking, and there is the young lady in the shower, and we go over, and the first assistant opens the curtain, and Vilmos comes in and stabs her with his dressed hand. So it was an extravaganza, I can tell you.
How many times did you have to take that shot?
Well, we did it slow, we did it fast. I think we did maybe 14 run-through, something like
and
that.
And was the goal each time to do it in one take?
Yeah, well, it ran. In general, we did an outside section, and there was a cut at the doorway, and then an inside section. My camera only holds 4 minutes of 35 good, so that restricted it. I think we originally shot it at about 8 minutes. It probably ran at 4 or 5 in the film, if you saw this thing. Also, Brian De Palma wanted it to be sort of really lurching, and I had a little trouble with that. I really wanted it to be really slick, you know. So I would lurch for a while, and then I'd slick it up on the move, and so on.
If you've seen the film, or if you haven't seen the film, the shot's right at the beginning of the movie, and it's a little disorienting at first because the film opens with a point of view of somebody lurking around, and then as the film develops, you find out that what you've just described, what Garrett has just shot, is actually a porno film, which is being worked on by John Travolta, and then the story takes off from there. Now, when you were shooting the film, was this in any way, did you have in the back of your mind what a slick, Steadicam porno film could look like?
Well, you know, from the beginning, various types have come, you know, rushing up, some foaming at the mouth, others not, and said, boy, this would be great in a porn film, you know. As yet, one of these guys has yet to ante up the cash for the services of myself, at least, you know. So I have yet to do my first porn film with this thing. I think it would be silly, actually, basically, but I don't know, possibly. Someday it'll happen, I'm sure.
And now, did you do any other shooting on the film, or were you present at any of the other production for Blowout?
No, I was on other things. As a matter of fact, an Eastern operator, East Coast operator named Dan Lerner did a lot of Steadicam stuff and also conventional stuff on the picture. And he did a number of the chase, you know, running and chase scenes and things through the Reading Terminal Market with, he happens to own one, and he is a Steadicam operator as well as regular operator, so he did quite a lot of it.
Did you work with Vilmos Zsigmond in your shooting of...
Yes. He's fun.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. He's extremely good. He's the cinematographer, obviously.
What's the relationship between the cinematographer who controls the overall visual appearance of a film and the Steadicam operator who really is controlling what's going to be shot, you know, during the time that you're shooting with the Steadicam?
Well, that is a really flexible relationship. Like, for instance, the relationship between the cinematographer and the director, which is, there are as many different versions of that one as there are guys doing the job. It's amazing. Some cinematographers entirely do the visuals and the shot design, and some are simply automatons for the director, and they push the gaffer around and do a little lighting. So it goes all up and down the map. My relationship with directors of photography varies equally. I mean, there are some guys that say, okay, here, this is what we want, just do whatever you want. And that's unusual, I would say, but it happens, and it's fun. You know, some of them figure, right, for better or worse, I've been running around with this thing for a long time, what do you want to do? But there's a hazard there. Usually you come on a picture for a few days, you don't know what the overall plan is, you don't know the style of the shooting. Is it lots of cuts? Is it long, you know, that kind of thing. So that's a little hazardous. For somebody like Brian, who I suspect controlled this shot fairly strongly, and for a strong personality like Zsigmond, who is... shot Close Encounters and The Rose, and, you know, he's just becoming a legendary character, cinematography-wise. Generally, you do precisely what you're told, and the mark, then, of somebody that does this Steadicam thing well is if you can do what you're told properly. You know, if they can say, I want you to come up here, stop exactly here holding this frame, and move to the left and hold this and hold that. If you can make the thing do that, why, that's considered a successful operation. I have a few ways of sending video pictures, for instance, to people on the sidelines, and I like showing people what I'm doing. You know, the fewer surprises, the better. So it's kind of fun for me. Just that kind of shooting becomes an athletic act, really. It's like a little track meet.
Between the shooting that you did in Blowout, in which you play a perverted psycho sex killer, you're incorporating the point of view of that type. Altered States.
This is fun. Character roles.
Altered States, you had a character role, and like a Neanderthal man who had escaped from a isolation chamber and was running through the streets. Was it Los Angeles?
In fact, in Altered States, I actually was a objective camera. I was actually shooting this little guy, this ape man. So, in fact, I wasn't his point of view, but the point of view thing comes up frequently.
Right. Then the other film that really is, though, I think that the most extreme and well-developed point of view use of the Steadicam that I've seen is in Wolfen, where you're playing a killer wolf in New York.
Right.
Are you getting typecast for that type of a point of view shot? Is the Steadicam becoming its own character in that
way? I don't know. I got right after Wolfen, this is kind of funny, I got a call from the people shooting The Cat People, and could I do a cat point of view? And it was somewhat difficult to do the get the lens as low as required to do a wolf. I mean, there aren't too many wolves with an eye view at 6 feet, you know, so we needed about a 3-foot lens height for the wolves, and along comes a call from the cat people, and I was expecting that they would need a 1-foot lens height, which is going to be, I'd have to be on my knees to do that one with a thing. So that I never did ultimately shoot on that film. It went to a friend of mine in L.A., but I don't know. I would like to not be typecast for any particular kind of shooting. I mean, God help us, there'll be a worm, the attack of the worm people or the mole people, and we'll be subterranean with this thing.
Well, what other type of point of view shooting would be called upon? I mean, there's a wave of, like, point of view killing shots in films now, but is there something else other?
Well, this is a, you know what's funny about this, Dan, is the point of view shot has always been rather difficult to manage technically. I mean, let's face it, if you're looking ahead, you can't have a bunch of dolly rails there. So it is written that if you're looking ahead for a point of view shot, you're either on a crane and the shot's restricted to more or less the length of the crane arm as you move up with the crane, you know, looking kind of swinging over space, or you're bumping along sort of handheld. And there was a whole period where the point of view shots were handheld and so on. Now it's much easier, and I think there's going to be a lot of that in horror films because it's a natural, you know, stalking somebody, knife in hand. I'm sure that's not the last we've seen of that routine. I also get calls for commercials frequently. For instance, I did a commercial for a phone company selling the idea of an extension phone, and the point of view was of my hands holding a newspaper. And the newspaper lowers, and they dubbed in the ringing of a distant telephone, right? There's a St. Bernard sitting there, and I had to sort of run over the poor St. Bernard, race down a hallway, nearly collide with somebody who skidded out of sight on a piece of soap, run down the stairs playing dodgeball with a cat and a medicine ball that was down there, and then past a kid, catatonic on the living room floor looking at television, you know, who, you know, sort of darting among all these things, and racing in and a hand entering, grabbing the phone. And all this in, you know, 27 seconds. And that, you know, there was no way for them to do that previously. So that sort of thing keeps coming up. But I'll tell you what I like. I like production shots. I like carrying this thing, imitating the classic machinery of film. It's almost like takes the most extreme concentration and is the most fun, really, when you pull one of those off.
You had to do a lot of that, I think. Well, a mix of things unique to the Steadicam, but also essentially doing production shots in close quarters in The Shining, right?
Most of that was production. There was very little point of view in that. And most of that was, you know, our camera's eye view, whatever that might be.
Well, you wrote in an article that up to that point, the work you did in The Shining was the most demanding work for the Steadicam and most challenging. Why was that?
Well, first of all, it needed to be incredibly precise to suit Kubrick, and also these sets, which you would remember if you've seen the picture, were filled with vertical pillars and designs, Aztec designs on the wall, and the Aztecs, bless their hearts, did not do wonderful swirls and circles. They did these rectilinear shapes, so if the camera wasn't precisely level, it was obvious from the shot with all the pillars and so on. So that the degree of precision that was required to walk around those sets was amazing. And then, if it wasn't that, it was outdoors in 3 feet of salt, running through the salt, which was impersonating snow, or it was running outdoor in the maze set, which actually was built on a stage, which was more salt and smoke and styrofoam and just incredible. So I think that was as hard as I've ever worked on a picture to date. And the Wolfen was even harder, actually.
When you did The Shining with Kubrick, were you showing him the video of what you were shooting?
Yeah, we had a wireless transmitter over there that sent the picture outside the set, and Stanley could sort of sit and look like a wrathful Nielsen family sitting there looking at the deteriorating video pictures we were sending and sending his commandments in by walkie-talkie.
You know, maybe you should just briefly explain why you can do that and how that relates to the concept of the Steadicam, what you're looking at when you're shooting.
Well, there is. I have a video image to look at because you can't obviously, if you're running up and down stairs, you can't put your eye on the eyepiece of a camera. It's gyrating. Your head is moving around too much. So the way we solved that problem was to provide the Steadicam operator with a little bright video image to look at. And since you've got a video image, then you can send it by wire or otherwise to other people, you know, who are on the set who want to see what you're shooting. And since you're doing, you're navigating and you're shooting at the same time, and since you every now and then have to look away so you don't fall down the stairs, it's a good idea that somebody watches continuously the frame.
Some of the shots in The Shining seemed to foreshadow what you were going to do in Wolfen, in that there were point of view shots close to the floor, going real fast, as if, well, for instance, the shot behind the bicycle in The Shining.
That's good. Very good, Dan. That's right. That was the beginning of that rig for low shots, yeah.
Did you learn much from The Shining which you were able to apply to Wolfen?
Well, this thing has been, you know, in a process of development for years. On The Shining, I had, for the first time, a chance to work on one picture for what amounted to a year, finally, although I was back and forth on other things. The production ran a year, and they had incredible resources. They were machine shops, and so just about anything I could think of, I could have made. And I took advantage of that to make some of these new gadgets, and that started a whole new wave of different techniques. I think in the country now there are half a dozen souls that now can do this routine with a low lens, and that was the rig that my friend used on The Cat People, for instance, and that set us up for the Wolfen. When Michael Wadley showed up with this item, it existed, and it was wonderful just to be able to say, come here, pal, I got a thing for you, and we...
Well, did Michael Wadley, did he pick up any cues from seeing The Shining as far as what could be possible
I'm not sure which came first. We had been having discussions, and I let him know that it was available, and this was the routine.
What type of point of view did you create for Wolfen, for Michael Wadley's film?
Well, point of view implies that the camera is not only just looking, but sometimes to an extent acting, and that's what's fun about it, as a matter of fact. You're acting to the extent that if you want to sell to the viewer this idea that this is somebody or something's viewpoint, for instance, the derelict and the pervert in Blowout, I was thinking, you know, in fact, Vilmos caught me a couple of times, you know, kind of, you know, making with the breaths, and, you know, it just comes with a roll. It felt better, you know, if you do a few pervert sort of breath thing, you know. And on the Wolfen, so help me, I'm sure I was running around making noises like a wolf, little, you know, growls and grunts and things. I've been told that I was. The Wolfen wanted to be a creature that could, first of all, move with incredible speed, that was highly intelligent. In other words, it wasn't just peering at the landscape like a vegetable, but was looking at things. Was shy or, you know, hiding in general, in hiding, concealing itself from other things. So this right away writes a set of rules for this critter, right? And you can imagine what fun it is to sort of now, having this tool that lets you run around with a camera, start impersonating a wolf. And the other missing hunk here is that we wanted the wolf to be able to go 20-some miles an hour, right? Now, obviously, your aging Steadicam operator can't get up to that kind of a speed with this thing, so we ran the camera at 12 frames per second. We had the actors walk slowly. And then when this shot is projected at 24 frames a second, it's twice as fast. So I was running half as fast as you see on some of these shots. So now all the acting that I did had to keep in mind that I had to move when I was acting a little slower than normal, in other words, in order to not make this thing look like, for instance, a mayfly instead of a wolf or a gerbil, you know, I mean, it had to have the right size, you know, and that's a factor from all effect shooting. When you're varying the camera speed, you've got to think about the size of the object. This thing still has to feel like it weighed, you know, 89 pounds or 140 pounds or whatever.
Well, the movements and the point of view of the wolf, or of the Wolfen, were really pivotal in the plot of the film, and it really was a character being created by camera movement. Did you create this with Michael Wadley together? How did this come about? How did you...
Well, it's an interesting story, actually, because the beginning of it took place in a churchyard at Third and Pine in Philadelphia, because Wadley came down with a few rolls of film in order to do a demo for his backers for the film and to show the optical people what they were going to be faced with in making these wolves come to life. And I brought my camera out and put this low rig on it, and he and I were looking for places to shoot. And as we drove by the churchyard, it was deserted. I should hate to think what the verger would have thought if he'd peered out the window, but I and Michael, who was wearing a brightly colored jacket with squares of color on it for the optical house, so he looked like just a lunatic, no question about it, were running around among the graves, and I was, you know, jumping down behind one and then coming up and peering over it and then darting after him, you know, running at 12 frames a second, the camera, where he sort of was running like in slow motion. So,
and this is camera close to the ground?
Camera close to the ground, you know, stopping, flying just over gravestones. We experimented with great leaps, and this is now we're developing this character, you know. Should this wolf make great leaps or should the camera go straight? We found the great leaps were a little confusing because it looked like it was being pursued by a rabbit or possibly a kangaroo, you know, so, or a gazelle. I mean, it may be that a wolf would leap, but it didn't work.
Not with the grace of a steady camera.
No, trial and error is what it was. What turned out to be exciting was very rapid but straight ahead shots coming after somebody. And we did stuff where the camera came roaring up to his neck as if it was about to decapitate the fellow and so on. Now, anybody watching this routine would see looked like somebody chasing an escaped mental patient with a sewing machine. I mean, this is very bizarre.
Did you do much changing as the film went along? You know, because as you shoot something, you see the possibilities of what you've created as far as the point of view. And, you know, you might want to pursue that a little bit more or see something that's not working.
Yeah, that's sort of the usual process with a new thing like that. Some things go out the window and others... for instance, the filmmakers were entranced by this pile of rubble that they had brought into the Bronx. And believe it or not, they had to deliver rubble to this one section of the Bronx because it had been scoured clean when the buildings were taken down. So they delivered a wonderful collection of rubble that also contained, I learned to my sorrow, hunks of wire that were sticking out here and there. And I was doing a lot of shooting, running over the rubble, you know, just this was to illustrate how full of joy the wolves' lives are, that they, you know, are cavorting on the rubble. This was a great burden to me, this sequence, but it was, you know, to illustrate how great it is to be a wolf. Well, this particular wolf, ran into some of these loops of wire two or three times and fell down and broke his little wolfy camera all in pieces and was carried off to the restaurant for lunch with his little wolfen foot in the ice bucket, you know. So it was not a great pleasure for me to do the wolves cavorting. And I think that ultimately looked kind of silly, some of that stuff. Some of it was in, but not anywhere near as much as we shot. What was fun was to see the wolves really pursuing somebody, really stalking, really... You know, looking through windows.
That and also running up the stairs. That was some really amazing shooting.
Yeah, that was exuberant.
Now, was that particularly difficult, or by now do you have like the stairs routine down? Because I know that's something you're called a lot.
Well, I hate to admit it, but I have the stairs down. I'm good on the stairs, up and down.
Well,
yeah, that was easy.
That also wasn't the first time that you shot in the Bronx. You did Fort Apache, the Bronx. So
right.
And that's not the bomb quite as bombed out as the scene.
No, then actually the Wolfen was the most tranquil location I was ever on, to tell you the truth. Country, winter, Alps, you know, plains of Spain, you name it. The Wolfen was the least hassle, the most tranquil. The place is deserted. The only people that are there move in slow motion anyway and are no problem. And in this particular area, it's just burned out buildings, and it's, you know, maybe there's an odd, you know, dope deal going on in a basement someplace, but you just don't see anybody, so it was great. Fort Apache was right down in the thick of it, you know, with lots of crowding and, you know, cars mysteriously disappearing and so on.
Did you fear for your equipment at that point?
No, my equipment owes me nothing at this point, so I'd be thrilled if someone would walk off with these battered cases. Insurance would provide me with a new one.
Another thing that you did, and I think last time you were on Fresh Air, you were talking about this shot in anticipation of how you might be able to deal with it. Perhaps you had just done it, I'm not sure, but it's the shooting on the bridge that you did in Wolfen. I guess there were two bridges that you had to shoot on.
I shot on only one. I shot on the Brooklyn Bridge. There was a lot of discussion. Actually, here's what happened was we were discussing what our plan was to get up the Manhattan Bridge, which is has a bigger cable but is a little steeper angle and is smaller up above. And the plan was to treat it like a mountain climbing expedition, but in fact the weather moderated and became calm and they had to go up and shoot it handheld because I was on something else. But I did work on the Brooklyn Bridge, folks, and I did walk up the cable to the Brooklyn Bridge, which was real exciting. And I have had my fill of that particular activity. I don't think I'll need to do that again.
Well, does wearing the Steadicam make it like particularly more vulnerable to losing your balance as far as walking on a narrow ridge?
Well, I wore it on top. We actually schlepped it up the cable. I didn't need to wear it going up, but wore it on shots moving around the top, which are most of which are in the picture, which are astounding. There's no good way to get a dolly up there, so that was kind of nice. It was the only way they could get a moving shot from that altitude.
Well, on top of what the camera work was for the point of view of the wolves, an additional element was added by manipulating the film in some way so that you were seeing it through a wolf's eyes. It looked to me a little bit, to an untrained eye of, like mine, not knowing what the process could be, like it was transferred to video and then put through some process or something. But can you tell how that was done?
Well, some of it was done well, and some of it was done inexpensively in a hurry at the end. Now, I'm sure you can tell as you watch the film which is which. The best of it is quite good, and the best of it was the wolves, for instance, at night, what we're saying is that they can see better than folks, okay? So I actually shot those scenes during the day, and now the optical house has got to make the sky black and then give it a kind of funny look so that you'll believe that it's night. But basically, a scene like that you can believe is night if the sky is black. If the sky is light, then it's obviously day. So the classic Western day for night is a funny old trick where they'll put a filter on the camera that makes the sky look dark. This is in black and white. You know, you put a red filter on, the blue sky looks black, and okay, boom, day for night. Now color came along, now it's a little problem. Remember your Westerns from the 60s and 50s, if you saw a night scene, it was shot during the day, underexposed a little bit, and they just brought the sky real dark blue with a Pola filter, you know. This doesn't work anymore. I mean, this now, you know, we had to have the optical house actually do what amounts to paint out all the sky with black. The old way they did that was little ladies or gentlemen sitting at a table with paint, with the film frame projected down in front of them, literally painting out all the sky.
On a 35-millimeter frame?
No, well, they project the frame, they paint it on art, and they shoot the frame big and reduce it to the same size, and that frame, the expression is, holds back the sky. It's a mat that holds back the sky.
Oh, I see. So when the film, when it's optically printed and projected,
ain't no sky left in it.
Right.
That's right. This was done now by a more automated way. You know, they have a film that is sensitive suddenly to a certain light level, and boing, anything over that light level, it goes black, so that the little ladies only really had to touch up the obvious problems. For instance, if somebody had white eyes, you shouldn't want their eyes to go black, so what I'm saying.
Did you know when you were doing all this what it was going to look like? Because there's so many new processes and variables involved. I guess it's stuff that could have really looked terrible if it didn't work out.
We went for it. I mean, I think they just barely did it, and since they did it, it's great. If they, we were prepared to be anything up to embarrassed when we went to the premiere by it, because who knew? You know, the early reports were that everyone loved it, and I think somebody in Newsweek had reviewed it favorably, and so we were suddenly, you know, sigh of relief. And then we saw it in the premiere in New York, and it looked great. So I was thrilled. But you're always, the opticals are becoming so important in the movie business, and there are so many chances for error that, you know, it's a hazard. I almost yearn for a return to more simple kind of shooting, because that the optical thing then just is tons of money and, you know, months and months in post-production.
I'll tell you one thing about the film that was not innovative optically or necessarily with how it was shot, but was nevertheless very arresting, was the morgue scene, which looks very realistic, very genuine. It was really depressing to watch. It was a morgue where, you know, there are bodies being rolled in and out, and you see the storage type of facilities and the autopsy type of facilities. Did you get on that set or shoot any of that?
I was just on it. I would like to have shot some of that, but they had a good floor, and they were already underway with a dolly shot, so I just was in that day and strolled around and looked. A large part of why that worked was because Greg Hines is so good. I mean, he sold that scene, you know, as the medical examiner. It was terrific, and the bodies and so on all became exactly what they should have been, which is just the day-to-day paraphernalia in the morgue, and you got kind of just a quick look by at these things. Beautifully cut as well, I'm sure you'd agree.
Was it a real morgue with real bodies?
It was a real morgue. The bodies weren't real. The bodies were made up. We had trouble getting the relatives of any of these souls to agree to have the bodies in there.
Well, one thing that...
I hate to even imagine those conversations. Hello, Mrs. Oh, my God.
One thing that I wonder about is when you're present on a set, and something looks very real when you see it in the movies, if it looks that real on the set, or if the blood looks more like coffee and the bodies look more like plastic bags or whatever, you know, whatever's used.
No, you have to back up and think of the final film to buy any of it when you're on the set, because it all looks more or less like movie stuff. For instance, there's a scene in which the inspector is decapitated, and the close-up where he's not quite dead, as they say, it was shot with himself down underneath a box and his head sticking up through the box. I think I can say this now because the film is leaving distribution here. And a false cut-off head deal at his throat, and the top of the box was dressed like pavement to match the street exactly, and then was filled in with modeling clay, so it looked like there the head is just lolling there, and his principal job was to let his head roll around that looked as if it wasn't connected to anything. And we sat there and watched and thought, this will never work, never work. And sure enough, in the film, they cut to it, it did work. They cut to it for 18 frames or so, and it's just enough to horrify you. Looks like a decapitated head, unless they decapitated the real guy after I left, which is possible.
Did you see the stuntman?
Yes.
Because that had, for instance, the stuntman, part of the plot of the stuntman was the making of a film within the film that you're in the theater watching. So there's a war film being made, and there are bodies being blown up, and people are watching this film being made, and, for instance, there's a fight on a beach, and all of a sudden... the airplane fight that you'd be from your standard World War II type of film seems to get a little bit out of hand, and by the end of the scene that's being shot, it looks like there's been real mutilation going on, and then lo and behold, people pull their arms out of protective casts and stuff like that. Have you ever seen anything that ambitious be shot or participated in any war type of shooting that gets that bloody and violent?
Well, that I think the stuntman, that scene was almost deliberately the ultimate, the maximum of all of that, and it was wonderful the way they did it, because they let us believe that it had gotten out of hand. They showed it to us as if we were the audience for the real war picture, and then they showed us once again the wider perspective of the filmmakers. I loved that. That was great.
You know, the shot that you were just talking about in Wolfen, was done in Central Park, right?
No, that was Wall Street, was the locale of that decapitation scene down in Wall Street.
Okay, well, one of the earlier shots that I'm thinking of was done in Central Park. I think one of the earlier murders.
Right.
That's not the first time you shot in Central Park. You did Marathon Man there, and what else? Altered States, was that in Central Park?
Yeah, some of that, and also a number of commercials there, and also home box office intermissions, three or four of those.
Are they getting to know you at this point in Central Park?
I start seeing the same people over and over again. Hey, how you doing, Jack? Yeah, this is true, I guess. There's some locales there that one sees the same people over and over.
Any other places that you keep being called back to shoot at?
Oh, let's see. Times Square. I've shot an awful lot in Times Square. Same deal. I mean, some of the local characters say, hey, he's back. Where else? In Los Angeles, it's all the studio streets, or it's off someplace on location, so it's not really the same thing. But
yeah,
there are a lot of places in New York that one does tend to come back to frequently. Times Square. I mean, how could you shoot New York without being around there? Oh, I know, the West 70s also, up, you know, 76th Street, 5th Avenue, that whole area, frequently there. One old lady that I think I've knocked down about three times.
Do you find yourself making, like, saying to yourself, oh, boy, I made this shot last week or last month or you know, when you visit a location like that?
Sometimes. There is some repetition.
Would you point that out to a director?
I did, as a matter of fact, and let me think what the instance was. Yeah, I can't recall offhand, but I have pointed out to somebody that I did a shot, for instance, in exactly the same way, and sometimes they say, fine, I don't care, and sometimes they say, oh, well, thanks, we'll change it. It depends on whether the means of getting the shot is really important or the content or so on.
Well, now you've been working with the Steadicam for, what, about 7 years, 8 years? Or has it been that long?
Seven altogether, I think, yeah.
Okay. What can you do now that you couldn't do when you first started?
Well, I can use it a lot better, I can tell you that. I see some of the earlier stuff that I did, and it's on the verge of being embarrassing. The shots up the stairs in Rocky, for instance, by today's standards, are very poorly executed. You know, the horizon rolls and the framing is inexact. And that particular scene was shot with one of the very earliest prototypes with a terrible video image. And, you know, in fact, the director of photography running along behind with two car batteries merely to keep it running in the cold here. So that era is long gone. I'd say it's gotten much more precise than it used to be. And, of course, we have ways of shooting in a lot of new directions and new tricks. It's sort of like skiing, you know. We're getting out of the Norwegian wooden ski era, and it's getting to be more specialized. Very exciting. I mean, I teach these workshops twice or thrice yearly, and it's amazing how much material is accumulated, because this is not like any other kind of shooting or even any other human activity I can think of. It's really kind of a unique thing for the body to do, and we're just pioneers, you know. We're waiting around trying to figure it out.
When the Steadicam initially came out, I remember in an earlier interview you talking about some of the, like, standard Steadicam cliches, that you're getting calls from all over the world to do, like, the same thing in different contexts.
Running up the stairs, and yeah. Well, people, you know, do things in cycles like that. That's diminishing, fortunately. I don't get quite as many calls, you know, wild-eyed guys running up saying, oh, here it is, now is your chance to run up the stairs and down and jump over the thing, you know. I mean, by this time, I have been on roller skates with the thing, on horseback. I wouldn't recommend either of those activities to anybody who wants to live a long and fruitful life. I've been, you know, run, jump, skips, ridden on skateboards, sat on what the English quaintly refer to as a sack barrel, which is one of those little, you know, workman's dollies. Been swung in on ropes, dropped in on cranes, slid down slides, rode up and down special little hiding elevators that disappear into the floor. I mean, now the game is how do you... It's like gone back a generation. Okay, the cameraman can get around on his own feet. Now, how do we get the cameraman where we want him? I've been lifted up in altered states by stairs which were snuck in and then hauled away, and walked along a ledge on a building with another guy's out the window holding a bar so I had something to hold on to. And then the guys disappear, the bar disappears, the stairs come back in, and you go back down. I mean, when somebody was there to restrain the dogs from also climbing up the stairs, it never occurred to anybody that the dogs love to climb stairs and bite the cameraman. So, I mean, it's ridiculous.
What shot did you do on horseback? What was that from?
The only time I ever shot on horseback was for a Little House on the Prairie episode years ago, because I'm an abominable rider. I was being led. My horse was being led, and they picked the safest animal they could find and gave him a few Valiums and stuck me on him. And I was being led along at a trot, you know, trying to remember how to post and shooting. And then they stopped suddenly, and I almost went over the horse's head. So I said, all right, that's it for this. But we made a saddle that the Steadicam arm mounts on, and this is available for rent in Los Angeles. It's being used this week, I understand.
So what's the idea? Somebody leads the horse, and the horse is operating the camera?
No, in fact, what happens is the horse now carries the weight of the camera, because it's attached to this pommel of a Mexican saddle, built-up riding saddle or roping saddle. And now the cameraman simply guides the thing with his hand. He doesn't have to wear the suit and bear the weight of it. And the major advantage is if the horse shies or flips our cameraman off, he isn't wearing this whole hardware store full of stuff. The horse can run away with this thing flogging. The mind boggles. You know.
Well, you told me that you were working on you worked on a Coke commercial with the Harlem Globetrotters. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, that was great. That was that was a week or so ago in, where was it? Los Angeles, on a wonderful little park. And it's one of those great Coke scenarios, you know, there's kids playing and a bus comes by, the Globetrotters, and there's a little guy selling Coke. And I shouldn't give this away. I'm sure they don't want their new spot to be a flag. But the upshot was that some great opportunities to shoot, you know, all that wonderful Globetrotter business as if I was among them, one of those guys. You know, we choreographed the thing, so I was in and out of them, and, you know, there's Geese and Curly and all these great guys doing their routine, you know, low shots looking up at it and, you know, rushing up to the basket and the camera flying up as the guy dunks and,
So great. Now you're basketball in addition to being a killer and a...
Great, yeah, right. I'm a Globetrotter now.
There's another film that you've been working on recently in New York called A Little Sex. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that's a comedy starring Tim Matheson. It's I guess what you'd call a light comedy. It's not out yet, and I don't know a great deal about the story, but I had a lot of fun on it. I did a chase scene, and this was one of the occasions where the director of photography is a friend of mine who... Ralph Boda, who was nominated for an Oscar last year for Coal Miner's Daughter. He, as a matter of fact, was the unfortunate fellow carrying the batteries up the stairs in the Rocky story, and he's a great guy. And he says, let's do a chase scene, he says, and you've done a lot of this. You do whatever you want for this chase scene. He says, all I want is these people to get from A here to B over there. And the deal was, let's see how I can describe this. The name of the film will tell you that we have to be careful here. Party A wanted to improve his relationship with Party B. And so Party B says, if you catch me, you can improve your relationship in this manner. So Party B goes running out through traffic, and A attempts to catch B and finally does on the stairs of a brownstone about three blocks away. And they're running through traffic the whole bit, right? So I'm now getting ready to enjoy my role as choreographer as well as shooter, and they start saying, well, this has to be in bright sunlight to match. I look up in the sky, and there are clouds going by. There's only sunlight for 30 seconds every 10 minutes. And they say a couple other requirements. Oh, yes, there's some stunts, taxis and things that have to hit these folks or nearly hit them, right? And it turned out to be a lot of fun for me because normally if you do a stunt in New York, what doesn't occur to you, but the biggest problem is waiting until the stunt cars go all the way around the block, which is one down, you know, two back, one over, and one back. This is an average 20-minute wait between. So we spent time during the cloudy parts planning this thing out to a fairly well so that there would be one shot at it when the sun came out, and we would get it once and not have to own the whole street and so on. And the advantage was, since we didn't have to lay rails and dolly track and all that, I could just simply wait, hiding in the shadow someplace. And when the sun came out, the police would go in and simply strategically stop traffic instantly where we needed them. Our cars, which were parked on the side, would come running out and do the stunt and continue up the street. And no one noticed that in the background where traffic was stalled way in the background. And it worked great. We managed to get a very complicated sequence, you know, just one shot every time the sun came out all day. And the final shot was what would normally be a crane shot on 76th or 75th Street. And there was no way to get a crane in this place without closing the street down for hours. So we had the grips build a little staircase, and they simply schlepped that in and just ran down the stairs. So to kind of twist back to your earlier question, some of the stair stuff is now unbeknownst to the viewer, not really a stair shot, but production shots like cranes, you know, using the stairs for their ability to get the cameraman up and down, you know, that's all.
Are you a fan of chase scenes? Like, I don't know, like Bullet or The French Connection?
Well, yeah, I like that kind of stuff. But I mean, I wouldn't say I was a fan of it, but I did enjoy doing one with my gadget. You know, it was great fun. I mean, on the street, for instance, we did shots that just... shots almost like you've never seen in a picture. I mean, the camera going by pedestrians an inch away at high speed. The pedestrians were our extras, but and they were specially trained to not flinch as the lens went by an inch from their face.
Is there much... is there anything now that... that you've tried to do and you can't, but you're working on to be able to get that together, any type of shot or movement or?
Well, only a few very technical things. You know, since it is attached to you with an arm, and there are a few limitations. The arm is only so long, and you can only reach so far. And then there are the physical limitations. People call me up sometimes and say, I want to shoot the Boston Marathon with the Steadicam. Can I run alongside? And I say... I advise people like this to consult a psychiatrist because this is, you know, I mean, I have run maybe the most 200 yards, and then I was sent home in a pillowcase. I mean,
is that Marathon Man?
Yeah, as a matter of fact. I was 7 years younger then, too, and in reasonably good shape. After I ran 200 yards, I quit smoking and took a long vacation. I mean, this is not, the thing weighs 50 pounds, so you can imagine it's like running with a backpack. So there is now a super breed of new operators coming along who are intensely athletic, and I'm sure some of them will be doing new things with it that I would, you know, fear to even contemplate. But
now, at the moment, you're working on a film with Francis Ford Coppola and a film with Robert De Niro. Can you tell us a little bit about both of those projects?
Well, Coppola's film is called One from the Heart. I shot on the Warren Beatty film, The Reds. I worked on it in Spain a little bit and did a wild shot in Spain. And the cinematographer is Vittorio Storaro, who won the Oscar once back for Apocalypse. And he and Francis have worked together a lot. And so I ended up on The One from the Heart, which is this production of Coppola's and Zoetrope Studios. It's a love story set in Las Vegas. Only they have recreated Las Vegas, and you know, for all practical purposes, on the stages at Zoetrope. So it's Las Vegas, fantastic and you know, claustrophobic sets and just amazing lighting effects. And in this case, I was a production camera, and it was wonderful fun. You know, just having the lens where they wanted it. I was on the picture for certain key scenes when Terry Garr, who plays Franny, and Fred Forrest, who plays Hank, have arguments. They like the energy of the camera kind of sticking to them closely, almost like a referee to these arguments. And so all up and down this house and all throughout this complete house, we're roaring after them. And this is the location of this elevator, this klutzy contraption that pops up out of the floor and lifts me up to the second floor as they climb up, you know, and... astounding, really quite astounding. I had a lot of fun.
Now, it's been said a lot that what Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas on the Zoetrope Studios?
Well, Lucas is, you know, a contemporary of Francis. He's sort of another one of the young, exciting guys, but not on Zoetrope. He's got his own operation.
Well, that between Coppola and Lucas, that there is really a new studio system developing of almost equal... or at least comparative power and size in the movie industry today as what used to exist as movies.
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, I'd like to see that happen, but it's in a very embryonic state right now. Coppola's studio is small and plagued with various money problems, somewhat, I imagine, undercapitalized for becoming a big studio. And let's face it, it's frightfully expensive to make movies today, and it's expensive to have anybody on the payroll. And the studio system demands... layers of people, craftsmen and apprentices, and you know, it's a wonderful setup if he can pull it off. I wish him well. Lucas has a lot more capital at the moment because of his fantastic success of his films, and he is building somewhat enigmatically this complex up in Marin County, and this may turn out to be a studio that will rival any of the old-time studios.
Have you been there? Have you seen
it? No, I haven't seen it. I'd love to go up there. It's largely mysterious so far.
How about the film that you're working on with Robert De Niro, True Confessions?
That one is finished, and as a matter of fact, I'm working Monday on one called King of Comedy, which he's in with Jerry Lewis. True Confessions was, let's see, Robert Duvall and De Niro, and that's due out. I imagine they'll bring that out this fall.
How about the King of Comedy project?
That I don't know much about the picture. I'm doing shots in a, on the 8th floor of a building on 36th Street. I just got the call. I have no idea what or where. Whatever. That's kind of part of the fun of this. You show up, you know, as a journeyman, not as a player on the picture for months. And it's always something new. It's always surprising.
How far ahead are you booked? How do you schedule yourself?
I have bookings in 1982. People will say, hold May 1982. You know, they know it's sort of a joke. I mean, schedules change violently, but it's nice. And, you know, generally the bookings get firm near the last minute because there are always weather and people falling behind. And this spring I was on six films at once at one time, jumping back and forth, and everyone's schedule changing, and it was a nightmare. I almost decided to pack it in. You know, it was too much, but...
Well, is it the nature of what you do that you could get a call from somebody that would want you overseas in a couple days? Or
yes, it has happened, yeah. I keep a passport open, I can tell you that. A lot of the times commercials, or somebody will run into a problem where they had a plan for getting a shot and they've wrecked the place and it doesn't work, you know, and then the finger and the phone start working and you get a call, can you... In fact, I missed one like that, and I'm very sorry I did. I missed a shot on Raiders, and I, at the time, for various reasons, I didn't pursue them very hard, and they didn't pursue me very hard. And now, having seen the film, that's a film I'd love to have worked on, and I really think that I was a fool for dragging my feet. But you never know, you know. You...
How about, are there any commercials that you've shot that are now on television in Philly that you see?
Let's see. There's a... Oh, this is silly. There's a Crest commercial on. Yeah, say no more. Say no more.
Okay,
Crest.
Well, what you can see now...
How are your checkups, by the way?
I guess that line did get into that one. What you can see in Philadelphia now is Blowout and Wolfen. And we were talking before we started the interview about where Wolfen is being shown and other... and where you can't see films and just the state of theaters in general in Philadelphia and maybe in the rest of the country.
Yeah, this is a problem. I think the movie business, from an exhibitor standpoint, is in big trouble. I mean, I'm sure everyone listening has been in theaters where the you hear the sound from the adjacent theater because they've been split up. You're at the end of a long, narrow tunnel because they've split it up. The screen is small and half of it's out of focus because the projectors aren't aimed right and the theaters are dirty. They're full of folks nowadays who think they're in their living rooms who are hooting at the screen and yelling at each other and describing the movie to their friend in the next seat. And so the act of going to the movies in an urban setting is becoming more of trouble than it's worth. I think it's going to push us all into the home video deal or, you know, cable or, if you're lucky, you know, the suburban theater maybe is still worth going to. It's a problem. It really is. It's a shame to sit there, watch something you've worked on and have to defend yourself with popcorn boxes.
Well, any other projects that you're working on that you want to give a brief preview to? We have about a minute.
Oh, nothing special, nothing extraordinary.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for coming back to Fresh Air, and I hope we'll see you, you know, after another round of films that you shot, and you can come back and talk about.
Upcoming is let's see, what is due out? Looking to Get Out is a film that's due out, and Four Friends, and Death Trap just opened. I have a nice shot on that. Sharky's Machine is the Burt Reynolds film that's due. So I guess there'll be another round. Well, good. I hope we
good.
Can see you soon.
Okay, well, thanks again.
A pleasure.
We've been spending the last hour with Garrett Brown, who is the inventor of the Steadicam and one of the most in-demand Steadicam operators. And Garrett has mentioned some of the films that you can see his work in, also in Blowout and in Wolfen. And I do want to... Really...
Oh, by the way, I didn't work on Endless Love, just to clear up the record.
Okay. I do want to compliment you for your work in Wolfen, which I thought was really...
Thanks.
Really.